Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Sunil Yapa, whose debut novel is The Heart is a Muscle the Size of a Fist. We'll also hear from young adult author Bruta Sepetys, whose third novel is Salt to the Sea. Sunil Yapa has an author's bio that makes a reader want to know more. He's the biracial son of a Sri Lankan father, a Marxist geographer, and a mother from Montana. He's lived in Greece, Guatemala, Chile, Argentina, China, and India, as well as London, Montreal, and New York City. Today, we'll be talking about his impressive debut novel, Your Heart is a Muscle the Size of a Fist, set in Seattle during the World Trade Organization riots of 1999. Believe me when I say this is a must read. Sunil Yapa, welcome to The Reading Life.
Oh, thank you so much.
Now, in all those places you've lived, you neglected to mention that you'd also lived in New Orleans and while you were writing this book. So what was your experience here? What was it like for you?
I love New Orleans. New Orleans is one of my second homes, to be honest. I lived there because my good friend Dan Packard lives in New Orleans, and I was at various times completely broke while writing this book. I would make a little bit of money and then try to write for a month, and then make a little bit more money and try to write for a month. And Dan graciously invited me to sleep on an air mattress in an empty room in his house on Roman Street, Roman and Napoleon. And I came down because I love New Orleans. And every month I would be faced with that decision. I could either buy a bed with the money I've made this month from doing little odd jobs, or I could pay him rent and write for another month. And for 6 months, I made the decision to keep writing. And so I slept on an air mattress in an empty room for about 6 months. Yeah.
Well, that says a lot about the love of place, I have to say. Now, this is one of those novels that dares to situate itself in specific history and specific place, and that can be a very risky business. So what made you feel so passionately that this was your true subject?
When the protest happened in November of 1999, I was in college at Penn State, all the way across the country. And studying actually with my dad, who teaches at Penn State. And my dad teaches economic geography. He's a Marxist geographer. And so I grew up in this milieu, and I knew a lot about the protests, and the ideas of global inequalities are incredibly important to me. And the protest was an incredibly important moment to me, even though I wasn't there. It was one of those moments where you feel less alone, where you see 50,000 people in the street that believe what you believe. And for me, that was a profound moment. And I never thought about writing a book about it. And when I was in grad school, almost 10 years later, I was casting about for novel ideas. And I read Don DeLillo's Libra, which is a retelling of Lee Harvey Oswald's life leading up to the JFK assassination. And I thought, wow, and it's a wonderful, powerful, incredible look into Lee Harvey Oswald's life that isn't necessarily 100% accurate. And there's a great, great, great section that take place in New Orleans and things that you just wouldn't imagine, things that take place in Japan. And I thought, wow, you can write a novel about a recent historical event. And then it popped into my mind, I want to write about Seattle, because that was a moment that really moved me, that really touched me. But it was also a moment where we saw a protest that was global, that people were caring about people in other countries that they might never meet, but they were willing to go into the streets and take the tear gas, unfortunately, and pepper spray of the police to say what's happening in the world isn't right. This needs to change.
And then you actually had to go to Seattle and research this.
Well, yeah, that's right. So I started writing, and I had a few characters, and I tried to write as much as I could before I did my research, just to see what I knew, and it wasn't a whole lot. I got about maybe 100 pages in, if that. And then I went to Seattle, and you said it was a danger, and it's also a blessing to write about a current historical event because there was an amazing amount of resources. There was, first of all, an amazing amount of people for me to talk to and show my manuscript to, but also I found in the basement of the University of Washington an incredible archive of materials, probably 25 boxes of things that people had been sending in material. So there was actual costumes from the day. Part of the protest was almost like Mardi Gras in a way, like people wearing costumes and dancing and a lot of music and drums. And one of the costumes that people wore that became very famous were sea turtle costumes. And so those kind of things were in the boxes. There was also a box of VHS tapes. There was firsthand accounts, photographs. So incredible resources there. And I also went to the city archives and I found there 5 days of the police scanner traffic. So
wow.
I got to listen to the cops just talking back and forth, and then starting out fairly pretty much what you would expect, and then as they became more and more overwhelmed, becoming nervous, and then frankly being scared. And you can hear in the background the enormous crowd noise. And so you can understand why these cops are getting a little bit scared. And that, for me, was one of the first ways into being able to write from the perspective of the police.
And what a testimony to the power of archives that these things
right.
were saved for you.
That's right. And for me, as a novelist, I'm not a good interviewer. So I would interview people and they would tell me their story and it was a good story, but it was their story and it didn't set off my imagination. Looking at stuff on the internet, and there was a lot, that also didn't set off my imagination, but holding things in my hand and being able to read people's very intimate diary accounts or firsthand accounts of what happened. Or I was also very lucky to, I don't know if you remember before the days of the internet, before blogs, people made handmade blogs. They were called zines. You know, you take a couple sheets and you write your thoughts, you do some cartoons, right? You write some political essays, and then you Xerox copy that and send it out to all your friends. And I was lucky enough to live with an activist who was in Seattle, and he had a shelf full of zines that he shared with me. I mean, that was an incredible resource. And those are things that you could hold in your hands that it's real physical history. And of course, I went to the streets and walked around in Seattle and you know, tried to absorb that too.
Well, out of all that, you created these remarkable characters, this police chief of Seattle, his estranged son, two protesters, two police officers, and a single diplomatic delegate at the WTO meetings. And the diplomat feels that the fate of his country hangs in the balance, but everyone feels high stakes in this moment. So I'm curious, this required such generosity and empathy on your part.
Yeah, it's really interesting to reread it and realize that I did that. I had a note card above my desk that said, no villain. Because the protest, to me, I found a picture in the archives very early on. In fact, it was in a book called 5 Days That Shook the World. And it's a picture of a woman with long red hair, and she's on her knees, and she's clearly been hit by a baton, and she's bleeding from the forehead, and a stranger is taking care of her. And I thought, oh, wow, this is an incredible moment. This woman is willing to take a police baton because she cares about people in another country. She cares about people maybe making, you know, textiles in a sweatshop in Sri Lanka or in Vietnam. And that's an amazing moment. And that's an incredible moment of empathy and compassion. And it challenged me, I think, as a writer to try to have empathy for all of the characters that I was writing about. And so at first, the cops were a very easy target and a very easy villain for me to write about. They ran out of tear gas by noon on the second day. There's some pretty brutal scenes, unfortunately, in the book that actually happened. They were an easy villain, but I really wanted to challenge myself to try to understand what would make a rather ordinary person act in such an inhumane way. So I wanted to try to understand that.
And I love that you studied economic geography and that you cite your father as such an important mentor for teaching you about capitalism. Now, we don't always think of that as the stuff of great fiction, and yet it's essential to understanding life on our planet.
Yeah, I didn't either, to be honest. I had always wanted to be a writer since I was a kid, and certainly in high school, and then I took a few years off before I went to college and just sort of wandered around. Much like Victor, in fact, but my dad is from Sri Lanka and I'm a second generation immigrant, and he never told me this, but there's some sense that writing wasn't a serious thing to do with your life. My mom is also a nurse, and so teacher and a nurse for parents. There was a real sense in our family that taking care of people is an important part of what we do in life and what we choose as a profession, that service is very important. No one ever said that, but I think I just sort of absorbed it. And there was a part of me that didn't understand yet how writing could be of service to other people, how writing could speak to the larger issues in the world. And so I left writing and I went to study with my dad, who teaches economic geography and for 40 years taught Penn State students about poverty in the developing world and then also poverty here in the U.S. and ran a project in West Philly for almost 15 years. And it was really an inspiration to me. But I discovered I didn't want to be an academic and that my best talent or my best way to act in the world was to write stories. I was to write fiction. And when I found this idea to write about the Seattle protests, I was elated because all of a sudden, two of the biggest streams in my life came together into a big river. And I thought, wow, I can write something that I really care about. It's actually fiction. It's a novel. And it also feels like it's of service in a way. It's a challenge, it's an absolute challenge. And I was terrified. Because I thought, this is so boring. How can I write a novel about, you know, global capitalism and about a protest, but tell interesting stories? And really, you know, this is something that affects all of our lives. We've been saying for a long time after 9/11 that we live in a different world. And certainly that's true. Of course that's true. But we all know, particularly the middle class and the lower middle class, working middle class, we know we've been living in a different world in America since the 80s. And I grew up in Pennsylvania and, you know, saw steel mills closing and the factories and lots of jobs leaving the U.S. that we've been living in a different country for a long time because of globalization. And I wanted to talk about that. I wanted to bring that into the forefront of the conversation, too.
Well, you certainly did. And I, for one, am grateful for all those months you spent on that air mattress. mean, it's a truly amazing book. Oh, we've been talking with Sunil Yapa, whose new novel is Your Heart is a Muscle the Size of a Fist. You can meet him Friday, February 12th at 6 at Octavia Books. Sunil, thank you so much.
Oh, it was a pleasure, Susan.
Ruta Sepetys is one of the stars of young adult fiction. Her first book was Between Shades of Grey. Her second, Out of the Easy, was set in New Orleans. Both were nominated for the Carnegie Medal. Now she's back with an amazing third novel, Salt to the Sea, set during the wartime winter of 1945, as desperate refugees, four young people from four different countries, make their way toward a ship that they hope will take them to freedom. Ruta, it's such a pleasure to welcome you back to The Reading Life.
Thank you for having me.
Now, this is a book that is close to your heart in so many ways, and it's dedicated to your father. So I wish you'd tell us a little bit about him.
Oh, thank you for asking. Yes, I am the daughter of a refugee. My father fled from Lithuania during World War II and spent 9 years in refugee camps. And so the refugee narrative is something I've always been really passionate about, as my father often described what it was like to leave everything he'd ever known and loved behind.
Wow. And you had no way of knowing that we would have this unfolding refugee crisis going on at the same time this book would be coming out.
No, I didn't. I started researching the book in 2011, shortly after Between Shades of Grey came out. A relative came to me and said, Ruta, there is a secret story of World War II that history has opted to forget. And as I researched it, not only was there a hidden story, there was also this story of the refugees, as I said, that was close to my heart. And of course, I had no way of knowing that when the book would be released, that we would be amidst another refugee crisis ourselves.
And talk about this secret history. I mean, I had never heard of this maritime disaster. This is huge. It's a huge story.
It is a huge story, and I had never heard of it either. Everyone has heard of the Titanic and the Lusitania, these huge tragedies at sea. But during World War II, there was a ship that sank that was carrying 10,000 people, including 5,000 teenagers and children. And it sailed during an evacuation called Operation Hannibal, which took place in January of 1945 in the area that used to be East Prussia. And the Germans staged this large evacuation and commandeered every floating vessel imaginable. And one of the ships commandeered for the evacuation was a German cruise ship called the Wilhelm Gustloff. And the Gustloff held about 1,400 people, but when it sailed during this evacuation, it was carrying over 10,000 people, and it was torpedoed by the Soviets. It sank in 60 minutes, and 9,343 people lost their lives, and as I said, including 5,000 innocent children.
It's just stunning to think of that many people on a ship. That's an amazing story, just amazing. So you concentrate on telling this story through the viewpoints of four different young people, and it's a book that deals in powerful emotions. You introduce each of these characters with an emotion like guilt is a hunter, fame is a hunter, shame and fear. And I'm curious about what are the challenges you face when you write about such powerful emotions for young people?
Well, the challenge that I face, particularly with this novel, is representing the different cultural lenses that were part of the time period. We can all experience the same event, but depending the country that we're from, the family that we're from, we view it through a different lens. And in this part of history, certainly the Wilhelm Gustloff was a German ship, but on board there were Lithuanians, Latvians, Estonians, there were Croatians, there were some Poles and Czechs, and I wanted to give the reader an idea of what those lenses were like and how it would be different, even though, let's say, four teenagers could be on the ship, how each experience would be different. And the challenge I faced was making each voice unique, because I tell the story in alternating chapters of these four characters. And it was a big challenge to make the voice unique and authentically represent each culture.
And it's also a book about trust in a really basic way, which has to be earned.
Absolutely. And at the end of the war, the Germans were losing the war, but they weren't announcing that. Just the opposite. They were issuing propaganda that said, victory is ours. And they forbid these innocent civilians to evacuate because they thought if they staged a formal evacuation, that it would affect morale and people would know that they were losing the war. So they waited until the last minute, and many of these people didn't trust the regime, and they risked their lives to escape on their own. And many of them were alone, and along the way, these unlikely friendships and families formed on the road to evacuation, and they did have to trust one another.
Well, one of the young women, Joanna, is a healer, and it seems very important to you that you have that kind of energy in this book.
It definitely is. As I was researching this novel, there were storylines that I came across of several young nurses who were separated from their family and had wanted to pursue medicine or nursing, and they presented themselves for work at hospitals. And several of these young women, they were heroes to me. They helped evacuate young boys over minefields to get to the ships to take them to freedom. And these women sacrificed so much. And young women, I'm talking 15 to 18 years old, working at, you know, as nurses. And I wanted to represent that narrative in the story.
Well, she's so self-possessed and so generous and so, at the same time, very realistic in her assessment of the world. She's one of my favorite characters ever. So.
Oh, thank you.
But another one of the characters is a young Nazi named Alfred. And I'm sure his passages were very hard to write.
The character of Alfred was by far the most difficult character to write. And I'm grateful that you picked up on that. I did not want to write a portrayal of a sympathetic Nazi. Instead, what I was trying to establish was more of an investigation of isolation and separation and visibility. And what I mean by that is you know, reports say that the human gaze is one of the most powerful tools that we have, and that when someone looks at us, that is when we truly exist. And so I've often wondered, for these young people who feel that no one looks at them and they're just ignored, what happens to those people? And then suddenly, if, let's say, in the case of World War II, at the end of the war, when the Germans were so desperate and they were recruiting absolutely everyone and people who had been passed over for the draft previously, suddenly became part of this Nazi power. With the character of Alfred, I was trying to explore what happens to a boy like Alfred, who is previously ignored but suddenly becomes very visible, and even if it's visible in his own mind, and how his psyche would change and how he would assume that power and what he would do with that power.
Well, he was fascinating. He was a really well-drawn character, I think. But it's so interesting to me that you know the framework, you know the ship's going to sink, you know all these four characters are headed toward the ship. And at the same time, the suspense just mounts and mounts and mounts. And the whole time you're reading, you know, you're like sitting there going, don't go in there. I mean, it's just, it's an amazing experience. But one of the things that I thought you did so brilliantly was to create the unexpected things that they encountered along the road. I mean, the absolute difficulty of bearing witness to so much tragedy, of searching for food and clothing, and that wonderful character who talks about the importance of shoes.
Yes, one of my favorite characters in the novel, and I'm so happy that you brought him up, is a character that I call the shoe poet. And this is an elderly man who is on this trek toward freedom. And he is a shoemaker, and he evaluates everyone by the way they walk. He tells us that if you have a foot draft of someone, it tells us much more than just a fingerprint. It tells us if they've had prior injuries. He can look at a shoe and tell you about someone's foot and why they wear those kind of shoes. But in addition, he was a character through which I was able to give voice to, let's say, some more philosophical thoughts, you know, of an elderly man who then to some becomes even sort of a grandfather figure.
He's the one you want to be on the road with, I think.
Yes. And Susan, that ties back to, you know, the tie-in of, you know, today's refugee crisis when, you know, you say he's the one that we want to be on the road with. And, you know, it really makes me think as I see these news reports, who are these people behind the fence? We know that behind innovation and creativity and science and technology is humanity. And maybe those people are the human capital that we need to make the world a better and safer place. And the character of the shoe poet is an example of that. Maybe someone would write him off, oh, he's an old man and, you know, isn't worth anything. And, you know, to dehumanize these people. So I hope in the character of the shoe poet, you know, people can see the value of a human life no matter what age.
And tell us a little bit about the research you did for this book, because it was considerable.
Yes, I spent 3.5 years researching the book, and I traveled to half a dozen countries, because when the ship sank, there were very few survivors. Out of, you know, the 10,000 people, only 900 survived. But those survivors, they went, some went to Denmark, some went to Sweden, some went back to Germany, some ended up in the United States and South Africa. And I wanted to track down these stories. And I started off the coast of Poland because that's where the ship sank. And my publisher in Poland connected me to two divers who were enlisted by the Soviet regime to dive the ship a few years after it had gone down. And these elderly gentlemen really brought the story to life for me. When they went down, they knew they were diving on assignment. They did not know that there were 9,000 people on that wreck, and it changed their lives. And being able to meet with these men and have them bring the story to life to me was incredible. And then, of course, families of the survivors and families of the victims, many of whom have spent their entire life trying to share this story, and said that it just sounds inconceivable. You know, when they tell people, that people say, wait, you're telling me there's a story 9 times the size of the Titanic and no one knows about it. I tell people I write the books, but history writes the story. And the history belongs to these people. And I could not have written the book without them. It was their story. And, you know, something else amazing about the research, when I went searching for stories, somehow the universe responded and story came searching to me. And now on the search, I'm getting emails and people are sending me photographs of their families who had taken passage on the ship before the evacuation. One man was a band leader on the Wilhelm Gustloff on this ship, and his family sent me his uniform saying, please show this to readers, show this to students. We want them to know about the Wilhelm Gustloff. And that part of the research has just been fascinating.
Oh, what a gift. What a gift. Well, it's a stunning book. It's such a great adventure story. It's such a wonderful moral and philosophical investigation. I can just imagine readers going, what would I have done in their shoes, as it were? So well done, my friend. Well done. We've been talking with Ruta Sepetys, whose amazing new book is Salt to the Sea. Ruta, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The Garden District Bookshop Book Club discusses Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel, Wednesday, February 10th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Maple Street Bookshop is starting a new book club. The first meeting is Thursday, February 11th at 5 at Maple Street Bookshop. Author Yuri Herrera will be on hand to discuss his novel, Signs Preceding the End of the World, the first selection. Today's guest, Sunil Yapa, discusses inside The Heart is a Muscle the Size of a Fist, Friday, February 12th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Octavia Books Book Club discusses The Love We Share Without Knowing by Christopher Marzak, Saturday, February 13th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Nancy Backus-Roniger signs A Bayou Home, The Adventures of Swamp Master Bijou, Saturday, February 13th at 11:30 at Maple Street Bookshop. Photographer Eugenia Uhl discusses how to make ribbon books, Saturday, February 13th at 10 a.m. at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. This is part of the monthly meeting of the New Orleans Lettering Arts Association. Participants must provide their own supplies and space is limited. Registration is required. Go to neworleanscalligraphy.org to register. Roberta Kaplan discusses and signs Then Comes Marriage, United States v. Windsor and the Defense of DOMA, Saturday, February 13th at 2 at Temple Sinai. Dr. Everett Gibson discusses his book, A Portrait of Southern University, History, Achievements, and Great Football Traditions. That's part of Black History Month, Tuesday, February 16th at noon in the State Library Seminar Center in Baton Rouge. Melanie Benjamin discusses and signs The Swans of Fifth Avenue, Tuesday, February 16th at 6 at Octavia Books. If your New Year's resolution is to jumpstart your writing, consider signing up for James Nolan's Creative Writing Workshop in Fiction and Nonfiction, which meets Tuesdays from 6:30 to 9 at Tubby and Coo's Mid-City Bookshop, running February 16th through May 17th. For tuition and registration info, write James Nolan at jnolan77@bellsouth.net. The Monday Night Writers Group meets every Monday night at 7 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. The members of the East Bank Regional Library Great Books Discussion Group discuss The Confessions of Nat Turner by William Styron, Tuesday, February 16th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.